Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, September 17, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our teleforum will discuss the President's recent executive order prohibiting discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity by federal contractors. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome to today's call three experts. We're going to hear from each of them in order. We'll get opening remarks of about 10 minutes, then maybe a little bit of back and forth, and then, as always, we'll be turning to the audience for your questions. Well, he'll hear first from Professor Carl H. Esbeck. He's the R.B. Rice Professor Emeritus and Isabel Wade and Paul C. Leida Professor of Law Emeritus at the University of Missouri Columbia School of Law. He'll be followed by Dr. Stanley W. Carlson Tees. He's the founder and president of Institutional Religious Freedom Alliance. He's also the senior fellow and former director of social policy studies at the Center for Public Justice, and the former director of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. And he will be followed by Professor Robin Fretwell Wilson. She's the director of the Program in Family Law and Policy at the University of Illinois College of Law. More complete bios for each of our speakers are available in the notice you received at today's call, so I'd direct you there for further information, but let's get right to the program. With that, Professor Esbeck, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. Well, our topic today is an apparent conflict between religious social service providers who quite often hire those of like-minded faith and this new executive order signed by the president just under 2 months ago, which is directed at federal contractors and their employment practices. It's thought that there's about 200,000 active federal contractors, and some on the call may be surprised that religious organizations make up that community, but they historically have. Although I might say quite often religious social service providers don't participate as contractors, but rather they take grants or what the federal government calls cooperative agreements. And the executive order does not apply to the latter two, only to contracts. And the new executive order, which was signed July 21st, adds two protected classes to the non-discrimination mandate, sexual orientation and gender identity. So the focus now is going to move away from the executive and to the Office for Federal Contract Compliance Programs, which is part of the Department of Labor. And it'll be up to the OFCCP to promulgate regulations to implement these two non-discrimination mandates. And they haven't yet notified the public through the Federal Register for public comment. So that particular process is probably not going to be completed until sometime the first half of next year. But let me just focus in on federal contracts. While this executive order does not include grants, it still has a very, very large sweep. For example, if you are a federal contractor, the non-discrimination mandate applies not only to the employees working on the federal contract, but all of your employees. In addition, if you have any subcontractors or vendors of goods, you must put in your purchase order or in your subcontract the same non-discrimination mandate. So it runs with the particular money that's involved. In addition, as a federal contractor, you're going to have to file probably annually compliance reports, so you're going to be disgorging entirely your employee profile as to gender and race and national origin and disability and veteran status. And now, apparently, those who identify themselves by sexual orientation and gender identity. And then Finally, one of the requirements is that you hold yourself out to the public as a federal contractor, that you're an equal opportunity employer on all of the particular protected bases. And if you're a religious organization, at least of traditional bent or traditional doctrine, of course, holding yourself out as to these two protected classes is certainly going to squeeze some of these faith-based organizations. All right, so looking at normally how our juridical regime has responded to these sort of large regulatory mandates is to put some sort of religious accommodation into the law. And here we have at least three layers of accommodation in the nature of religious liberty, or reflecting that there is religiously based conscience, which is seriously implicated here. So let me just name those three layers, and then I want to circle back to the first one. The first one is that there is an exemption in the executive order that was put in there back in December of 2002, so about 12 years ago. And that religious exemption was left untouched by the new executive order from 2 months ago. That particular exemption, which I'm going to talk a little bit more about, but it's almost identical to the one in Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which is the of course, the major non-discrimination mandate for private sector employers and a number of public sector employers. So there's a good deal of parallels between those two exemptions. Now, the second layer is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was newly invigorated in the Hobby Lobby decision, which came down at the end of June. And then the third layer, of course, is the First Amendment itself. Religion clauses, ministerial exemptions, freedom of expression, including religious expression, associational rights, unconstitutional conditions in the use of spending power, and so on and so on, that whole package, which we call simply First Amendment rights. So, like I said, I want to circle back to this particular exemption, which is in the executive order. It's in Section 204. Of the base executive order, which is sort of a venerable old Civil Rights Act that was first signed by the president in 1965, and it's called Executive Order 11246. And for some of the audience, I suspect you'll recognize that number, 11246. So the exemption is in 204, and 204 says that Section 202 of this order shall not apply to religious organizations as to their exercise of certain hiring rights and staffing rights on the basis of religion. And then if you look over on the executive order in Section 202, it begins with except in contracts exempted in accordance with Section 204. So, of course, that's just legal jargon saying not once but twice that the main non-discrimination mandates, which now include sexual orientation and gender identity, are subordinated to the exceptions over in 204, which include the religious exception. So then the focus becomes on, well, what is the scope of that particular religious exception? There's been long agreement that at least if there's no particular religious tenet which is being burdened, that religious organizations cannot discriminate on the protected bases, race, color, sex, veteran status, disabled status, and now newly added sexual orientation and gender identity. But the question comes is, well, what if there is a direct conflict with a particular religious tenet? So the case law under Title VII, which is certainly has strong parallels to this same language in the executive order, it says the courts, the federal circuits, have said, the Supreme Court has never gotten to this issue, but the federal circuits have said that religious organizations have permission to employ only persons whose beliefs or conduct are consistent with the employer's religious precepts. So if there's a direct conflict between a religious precept and the non-discrimination mandate, it would seem that Section 202 is subordinated to Section 204. So that kind of sets up the first layer of analysis, which is, of course, where most of the focus will be by OFCCP. And with that, let me turn it over to one of my panelists here, Dr. Stanley Carlson-Teese.
Thank you, Carl. I'm the founder and head of the Institutional Religious Freedom Alliance. You heard that. This is a network of faith-based service organizations that are very committed to maintaining their religious identity and faith-shaped practices when they serve the public. And as in that role, I was organizer of a letter to the president before the executive order asking that it include a religious organization exemption and not only retain the religious staffing exemption that Carl just spoke about. These 160 religious leaders and CEOs who signed the letter were asking for the same religious organization exemption in the executive order that has been in every ENDA bill, Employment Non-Discrimination Act bill, that Congress has so far considered. Such a religious organization exemption would exempt from the new non-discrimination requirements any religious organization that is free under Title VII to make staffing decisions based on religion. In that letter, we argued that only such a religious organization exemption would adequately protect the religious staffing rights of these organizations and thus allow them to continue to contract or subcontract with the federal government. Without that organizational exemption, the letter said, they'd be subject to continual second-guessing by courts and government officials when an employee or job applicant claimed to have been discriminated against because of his or her sexual orientation. The religious organization would say it was only exercising its statutory right to consider religion when making a staffing decision, but the applicant or employee would claim that instead the organization had engaged in prohibited sexual orientation discrimination, and then the Labor Department's contract compliance officials would have to step in and make their own decision, quite possibly ruling that the religious organization was confused and was mistaken about what it claim to be a faith-based employment decision, which would be perfectly legal. The only way to eliminate that kind of second-guessing, the letter said, this kind of substitution of the government's judgment of what had happened for the religious organization's effort to keep a staff that's faithful to its ethos, would be to exempt the religious organizations from the new non-discrimination requirements. The executive order hasn't been implemented yet, as you heard, but already the second-guessing has started, I think you could say. In fact, it started even before the president signed the order. Politico had an article a couple of days before the order in which a senior administration official was quoted as saying, you can use religion to only hire people who share your religion, but you can't discriminate against somebody who is of your faith who happens to be LGBT, end quote. But, of course, religious organizations that have a serious religious qualification for their employees don't treat religion as cavalierly as this senior administration official does. These organizations don't think religion's just a matter of what you say, but extends to what you do, and so they can't so easily accept as a compatible fellow believer a job applicant whose actions contradict what the organization thinks is an important mark of faithful commitment to the religion. Well, unless the regulations proposed by the Department of Labor bring clarity while upholding the religious staffing freedom that the LGBT executive order formally left intact, I think there's going to be both much litigation and a significant exit from federal contracting and subcontracting by faith-based organizations that maintain religiously based standards for their employees. So the question is this: where is the dividing line between the religious staffing freedom that is acknowledged by the executive order on the one side and the prohibition on sexual orientation employment discrimination that's now being applied to federal contractors? Or to put it another way, where's the dividing line between the now forbidden employment discrimination based on sexual orientation and the still legal employment decision-making based on religion? I think legal and constitutional experts, it's pretty clear, differ on this question, and I take it that such disagreement isn't due to ill will or sloppy reasoning, but is inherent in the subject matter, in the reality that neither sexual orientation nor religious identity are simply demographic characteristics that are easy to interpret. So I'm now going to borrow from a post I wrote for Cornerstone, the blog of the Religious Freedom Project at the Berkeley Center at Georgetown University. And in that post, I pointed out, in the case of religious staffing, that what's important to the employer is compatibility of convictions, values, and conduct, and not just a label, I'm of your religion. This isn't a matter, in other words, of a potential employee simply showing an ID card with the right religion checked off. You know, of course, there is no such ID card. And it seems to me, sexual orientation also has to do in some way with convictions, values, and conduct. Again, there's no ID card that an employer can inspect, no necessarily obvious characteristics to be noticed. And I take it that this values and conduct-laden reality about sexual orientation is one important reason why surveys about the size of the LGBT population return inconsistent results. So, for a religious employer who considers religion when hiring, what does such an employer do in these circumstances? Well, in a post for that same Cornerstone blog, Marty Lederman of Georgetown Law stated, "It remains to be seen whether any potential contractors would have the audacity to argue that an employee is not of the employer's particular religion just because the employee is gay or is transgendered or has slept with or married someone of the same sex." End quote. But in fact, it is common for religious employers to have a theologically based conservative sexual conduct code as part of their religious staffing practices, and they are thereby asserting that employees and prospective employees of whatever orientation aren't religiously compatible if they're sexually active outside of a man-woman marriage. In general, I think we wouldn't authorize the Department of Labor to decide, contrary to religious nonprofits' religious teachings, that two candidates, both Jane and candidate Sally, are appropriate hires because they both attend some branch of the Presbyterian Church, although one openly engages in extramarital affairs, while the other is faithful in her marriage. And I assume the department wouldn't rule that it's impermissible for a Catholic crisis pregnancy clinic to choose to hire Nurse Jake, who affirms the church's pro-life teachings, while rejecting Nurse Jack, who proudly states his agreement with Catholic support. Well, if the government should keep its hands off of religious employers' standards of conduct regarding affairs, marriage affairs, and abortion, why should it be allowed to penalize the same religious employer for its standards of conduct regarding homosexual conduct? All of these standards reflect long-held religious beliefs about what sexual conduct is and is not religiously acceptable. So I think we can agree in general that an applicant's sexual conduct should be irrelevant in staffing decisions, but that doesn't solve the critical question about the legitimate scope of religious employment decisions by religious organizations. Some say, well, but it's not that hard. Sexual orientation discrimination, just like racism, is clear-cut, but it's wrong. It has to be illegal. There can't be an exemption from the prohibition for religious organizations. But I think that certainty is a little bit misplaced. For example, the state-by-state examination of non-discrimination laws and policies published in mid-2012 by the Center for American Progress Action Fund, showed that every state that applies a sexual orientation non-discrimination requirement to private employers, in fact, has a religious exemption. And those exemptions are just noted without a challenge. And in fact, the report's introduction says it's important that the ENDA, when considered by Congress, should, quote, include explicit exemptions for religious organizations and religiously affiliated entities. You know, if the issue was racial discrimination, there wouldn't be any exemption in those laws, and the Senate wouldn't have agreed to an ENDA bill with a religious organization exemption. I realize that many are now critical about that exemption, despite having supported it just months ago, but my point's just that in considering sexual orientation discrimination, we're in a significantly different setting than when racial discrimination is the issue. Well, the question of what standards may be used by religious organizations in making staffing decisions isn't settled, I think, by saying that, of course, the federal government shouldn't allow contractors, as Professor Lederman said, to arbitrarily exclude from their workforce an entire category of qualified and talented employees simply on the basis of a characteristic that has nothing whatsoever to do with their ability to do the work. and I think that's a common view. But whether an employee reflects the religious values of a religious employer may, in fact, have much to do with his or her suitability for the position, according to the religious employer. Workplaces aren't simply collections of individuals, and suitability for a job requires more than a narrow ability to do the work. I think on that, you can consult all the companies and nonprofits that strive to create a positive and mission-supporting corporate culture. And I think, too, that broader understanding of qualifications and the nature of the workplace in a religious organization was specifically noted when the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously upheld the religious staffing freedom in 1987 in Corporation of the Presiding Bishop versus Amos. So let me just end with this. Because the line dividing the now forbidden employment discrimination based on sexual orientation from the still legal employment decision-making based on religion is not bright due to the nature of the issues involved, I think it's incumbent upon the Department of Labor to write regulations that set out a broad freedom for religious organizations to consider conduct and not only stated religious affiliation when they exercise their freedom to staff according to religion. So, on to you, Robin.
Thank you, Stanley. I appreciate that. So I'm Robin Wilson. I'm a law professor at the University of Illinois. I should say that these views are my own and that they're not those of the University of Illinois or any other group with which I'm affiliated or, more importantly, that pays me on a regular basis and allows me to pay my own mortgage. So let me talk a little bit about the executive order in the broader context of Hobby Lobby, of Arizona's very contentious fight only some months ago over amending Arizona's state-level Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA, and then even same-sex marriage exemptions and state same-sex marriage laws. Now, I should also tell you that I signed a letter to the Arizona governor urging her to decide on the facts when she decided whether to, and in fact did, veto Arizona's legislation. So as I said, I'd like to talk about that sort of historical context, recent historical context, and then also talk about challenges going forward. Now, Carl and Stanley both have explained that the executive order was in the works pre-Hobby Lobby, but that certainly did not stop many activists from linking the two issues after what they saw was a very bitter defeat in Hobby Lobby for them. So, for example, in a letter responding to Stanley's, which he has just described, Professor Catherine Franke at Columbia, joined by a load of scholars in the academy, basically said that existing religious hiring exemptions were already sufficient, and linking it to Hobby Lobby and the order in Wheaton College, they said that it does not, those things do not in any way compel the inclusion of religious exemptions that are broader than what was already there in pre-existing law, meaning the pre-existing executive order, that would then prohibit discrimination against LGBT employees of federal contractors. So they are leveraging Hobby Lobby as a way to push back, and they're not alone in that. So you know well that commentators from Newsweek to the LA Times predicted after Hobby Lobby that it would embolden employers to assert a religious right to deny other health benefits or in some other way discriminate against their employees based on religion. Now, it's not just the public that have said this. Religious liberty scholars like Paul Horowitz have connected Hobby Lobby and fights going forward, in particular, sees Hobby Lobby as a prelude to a dawning conflict over same-sex marriage. Now, I think one particular difficulty for the feasibility as well as the optics of protecting religious liberty after Hobby Lobby, whether it's a broadened exemption like the one that Stanley argued for in the executive order, or whether it's meaningful religious liberty exemptions and state-level same-sex marriage laws. But the challenge here will be what I call in a new piece the lawlessness narrative. And basically it is the claim that by exempting some religious beliefs from the laws that burden religious practice, as RFRA does, a generalized protection, or exempting some religious believers from what would be duties under anti-discrimination laws and, for example, same-sex marriage laws, that we somehow set them above the law. Now, as I say in this new piece, generalized protections sort of lend themselves to that critique in a way that's hard to articulate for many members of the public. But that specific exemptions and specific laws allowing religious believers to step off from particular duties do not. In And essentially what I say is that we often exempt, for example, small employers in a particular statute. And when we do that, we're in effect saying that the small employer never has a duty under that statute applied to them. And when we exempt them, we do not say, for example, that the small employer is somehow set above the law. And I argue that same-sex marriage exemptions and exemptions to, let's say, abortion and abortion conscience clauses and elsewhere basically do that. They establish that the law never applied to these people. And I think it's really, really important as a matter of our narrative going forward to emphasize that, that religious believers are no more allowed to ignore the law than, for example, a small employer or anyone else that we provide carve-outs to. Now, I think a second challenge for religious liberty protections going forward will be to ensure that any protection does not appear to be a rollback of existing anti-discrimination laws as a new or even an enlarged exemption like there might have been in the executive order would appear to do. Now, this is not new to the executive orders. In my conversations with state legislators arguing for same-sex exemptions to same-sex marriage laws, whether one is perceived as rolling back existing protections is extremely important to those legislators. So let me now say a word about Arizona. There's been a lot of misinformation, as we said in the Arizona letter, about what happened in Arizona. But basically, that bill would have amended Arizona's RFRA to speak definitively to a question that had split the courts, namely whether commercial businesses sued by another citizen, as opposed to the state, could even qualify for RFRA protection. But commentators latched onto this in the public and the media, to this arcane legal question, to then mean that businesses could turn away lesbian and gays for any reason or none at all, and that those businesses would always win because of this proposed amendment. Now, ironically, that fundamental misunderstanding was fostered by some religious liberty advocates who said publicly that they needed this amendment to, quote, stave off gay rights. Now, I should pause and say there were no gay rights in Arizona law, state law anyhow, to stave off or somehow contain. Arizona did not ban sexual orientation discrimination in housing, employment, or public accommodations in its state law, even though some of the municipalities did. So the project of bolstering religious liberty went off the rails in Arizona, I believe, because religious liberty advocates did not seek a more balanced, nuanced measure. For example, legislators could have granted the LGBT community these kinds of anti-discrimination protections in the same piece of legislation that was supposed to clarify whether businesses could claim protection under RFRA when they were sued by private parties. Now, basically, this both side wins equation, I think, is what distinguishes what happened in Arizona from what has happened historically in state same-sex marriage laws. In those laws, at the same moment that the state is recognizing a new right for same-sex couples, it is also protecting religious liberty in ways that we can recognize ex ante. It will obviously be impacted. What's important is that both sides win in the same piece of legislation. Now, I see the executive order as a bellwether for efforts going forward to protect religious liberty. And I think we have to be more thoughtful about the public narrative for why we need to protect religious liberty and how that will impact others. And I also think we need to carefully distinguish between specific exemptions like there are in abortion conscience clauses or same-sex marriage laws or even what would have been a specific exemption in the executive order from the kind of broader protections in Hobby Lobby and in Arizona. And I think emphasizing the circumscribed nature of an exemption will help in making that exemption more feasible and more acceptable to the public. So let me turn it back now to Dean.
Thank you very much. We're going to get to the audience questions momentarily. Before we do that, let me revert to Professor Esbeck and Dr. Stanley Carlson Thies to see if they have something in the shape of a very quick response before we go to the audience. First, Professor Esbeck.
This is Carl Esbeck. Well, let me just say that my two colleagues here certainly given us a larger agenda here, in that we're looking at a full array here of religious accommodations or religious exemptions, not just the one in this particular executive order. And as Robin said, the narrative here needs to be one where both sides see for themselves something very valuable. And you can call it a win-win, although I know that some are very find that phrase very tedious. I've used the phrase live and let live here is really another way of saying the accommodations to general legislation, and here we're talking about religious conscience accommodations, is what we ought to be about, where both can see that they're getting something very substantive in how the law is being settled going forward. We're in a liberal pluralist democracy where the deepest values that people hold, whether they're religious or non-religious, the deepest values that people hold, including their sexuality, everybody is in minority status. Nobody is in charge and is the majority. And so the safest thing all around is that we be very tolerant and very pluralistic. So in this particular executive order, we ought to resist the temptation to use federal spending power, with double underlined word power, to force people either to abandon the delivery of social services, which only hurts the poor and needy, or to simply recant in order to go forward and serve the people. So so if we could have that vision of being a liberal pluralist democracy where everybody is in minority status, then I think we're going to take care of other people because we also want to be taken care of ourselves.
Yeah, this is Stanley Carlson Teese. I just add to that, the executive order and these questions about the exemption and how these different aspects of the executive order go together, they just really do strike me, as both Robin and Carl have said, as part of this very big discussion in our society of how we deal with this religious freedom value that's been constitutive to us, but also the equality and treating different minorities in fair ways, new claimants to rights that have not been had their rights protected in the past. How do we deal with that? So this is, it's not, seems to me, a narrowly technical issue, but kind of a broader issue of how we live fairly with each other as we become more diverse. And by the way, it is kind of going to be more and more challenging, I think, to have more and more kind of general government laws as the public becomes more and more diverse and its institutions become more and more diverse with respect to very fundamental values of belief and conduct. So I think, going to be facing these issues very often. I'm struck by, with respect to religious liberty or religious freedom, that can be talked about in two ways or deployed in public debate in two ways. One is kind of as a hammer, and the other is as a wall. The hammer use is to say, you know, with regard to executive order or same-sex marriage or abortion rights or whatever, you know, if that becomes a law, it's going to really harm my religious community, other religious institutions, so you better not do it. So, in other words, just an argument to try to stop something that you are convinced is not good. The other use of religious liberty, religious freedom, I think is been the way it's been part of our life in America, is as a wall, as kind of protecting a space in which some people who the dissent, they're different from a majority or overlapping majorities, and just say before the face of God or in my conscience, we just have to live in a different way, give us some space to do that. And we're not telling you what to do, but help give us space to live the way we do. So I think that's a better use in our very diverse society, in which we need to find ways to live together despite pretty fundamental differences. But I think that's at stake as well in this LGBT executive order discussion.
Very good. I want to come back to Professor Wilson in just a moment. Before I do that, let's open the floor to questions and people can begin to queue up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, indicate so by pushing the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts or all of them, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. And we'll go to our questions momentarily. But first, Professor Wilson, did you want to augment your statement at all?
No, I just wanted to tell Stanley I'm going to rip off his argument about the hammer and the wall from my paper, which I'm actively editing to go back to the UC Davis Law Review today. So I think that's extremely helpful. If you are going to say you need religious liberty in order to keep the other guy down, you will lose. If instead you say we can advance the social progress project, even if I disagree with it, in a way that is not likely to impede that progress, you're not going to be a choke point on the path to progress, but you would be permitted to step off and not be asked to facilitate or somehow otherwise, violate your own deeply held religious convictions, then I think that's actually still tenable, even in the very heated climate after Hobby Lobby, even in the very heated climate after Arizona. But the key will be both sides need to win or have their interests affirmed in the same piece of legislation. We don't do that, I think it's a deal killer.
Professor Esbeck, is that possible? Do you agree with those sentiments or take issue with that?
Well, I agree that both sides need to be given a voice and their fingerprints are on the deal. It might be that the nature of the particular legislation that's going through, the words themselves may reflect only the interests of one side. But if the compromise that's put together involves both communities or three or four different communities, I think that's the only way legislation is going to actually get passed and signed by a governor or signed by a president in this particular environment. If either religious liberty or, for that matter, LGBT equality is to be used as a hammer, then that means government. Then there's a struggle to control the government, so that by controlling the government, you wield the hammer, and that leads to call it culture war, call it that divisive gridlock in not just in Washington D.C. but in a lot of state capitals as well. But it means that the whole prize goes to the momentary winner at the ballot box, and that's a ticket to a highly divisive democracy that calls into question whether it can hold itself together any longer. Whereas if people can say, yeah, you need to win and I need to win and we're all going to get something out of this, then we can live together with our deepest differences.
We've got one caller with a question on the line. If you would like to join the queue, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me make a brief announcement before we go to our first question. That is our next scheduled telephone conference call, scheduled for tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. We'll be getting a litigation update on the Fisher affirmative action case heard in the Supreme Court, decided in the Supreme Court, and now on remand to the lower court. Let's go to our first question.
Thank you, Dean, and good afternoon. I have a brief question for any of the three concerning scope. Is it clear that this executive order applies only to employment discrimination, or does it, or does any other executive order also apply to public accommodation?
Who wants to take a shot at that first?
This is Carl Esbeck. The executive order signed just short of 2 months ago deals entirely with federal contractors and employment discrimination. And it amended this venerable old executive order from 1965, 11246, which also deals simply with employment non-discrimination. There is, of course, a federal public accommodations non-discrimination law, Title II of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And so I'm thinking maybe that's the particular statute that you were thinking about.
If I may just follow up, I'm wondering if that Title II, either by regulation or executive order, has extended protection to LGBT non-discrimination.
Carl Esbeck again. I don't think that it has, and indeed, Title VII itself, which is employment discrimination, does not extend to LGBT. A number of federal courts, although not the U.S. Supreme Court, but a number of lower federal courts have been asked to treat sexual orientation discrimination as a form of sex discrimination under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and the courts have refused. And I'm pretty sure that Title II, which is public accommodations, I don't know if there's any case law on that, but I'm quite certain it has not been extended to LGBT. Now, maybe you're thinking of gender identity, where there is a movement afoot within the current executive branch to read non-discrimination on the basis of gender identity into Title VII and also into this executive order. But some other executive orders, Title IX of the Educational Amendments of 1972, which, of course, prohibits sex discrimination in institutions of higher education. And there the Department of Education is reading sex discrimination as also reaching gender identity discrimination. These are all regulatory movements not yet affirmed by the federal courts.
May I chime in? This is Robin Wilson. I don't know if the question was asked for this reason, but I can tell you I collect all of the sexual orientation non-discrimination statutes that are in state law. In a new article that's on something called SSRN, which is like the Social Science Research Network, and underneath that is a tab called LSN, or the Legal Scholarship Network. You could just Google my name. And the piece is called A Marriage of Necessity. It's forthcoming in the Case Western Law Review. And there's an appendix, I think, but if not, there's a footnote that collects every state-level sexual orientation non-discrimination law, whether it's in employment, education, hiring, public accommodations, or whatever the context. There is a second piece called Embracing Compromise, which is coming out in the Georgetown Secondary Journal on SSRN, also under my name, and it collects a number of municipalities that have this in state law, as Arizona did, for example, in Phoenix. And there I just cite to, and I would tell you what it is if I had it in front of me, but I cite to one of these documents from like GLAD or HRC, I can't remember who, that actually looked very good, very well done to me, that collected those municipal bans. So both pieces, between those two pieces, you should have a very good sense of what the state of the law is across the country if you want to look at them.
Thanks to you both.
So this is Stanley. If I can jump
Stanley,
in.
before we go to you, Professor Wilson, I think you might have caught people off guard with that first citation. I wonder if you could repeat that.
Let me repeat it. It's called A Marriage of Necessity, and then I think the subtitle is like Religious Liberty and Same-Sex Marriage or something. But it's probably the most recent post, and it's forthcoming in the Case Western Law Review. The easier way is if you simply want to send me an email at wils@illinois.edu, I will respond with the piece, and I can tell you which footnotes it's in or which appendix. The second is called Embracing Compromise. It's in a Georgetown Journal of Law and Gender or something like that, forthcoming also on SSRN. But again, if you just send me an email, I'll just tell you which pieces of it you want to look at for the municipalities.
Now, Professor Carlson, please.
Yeah, just really briefly, the executive order that the president just signed is about employment, but I think maybe 2 years ago, HUD, Housing and Urban Development, did issue a regulation about sexual orientation and I think gender identity discrimination in federally subsidized housing programs. And so that would be executive branch action. It's not the executive order. It would have to do with, one part of public accommodation. So I think we may see some action like that. And then, of course, Congress might step in. But this particular executive order just is about employment discrimination by federal contractors.
Thank you so much.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending. Let me break in here with a question of my own, and that's for any of the panelists. We've done quite a few of these teleform conference calls, a couple of them on disparate impact, the idea that when it comes to discrimination, you don't need to prove intent, but merely the results of an employment structure could indicate or would be an indication of disparate impact in a policy that's implemented by an employer, for example. Is there some intersection here in this executive order and the idea of disparate impact, or are those two separate things? Or does anybody know the answer to that question?
I think disparate impact does come in when there's not direct evidence of employment discrimination. The claimant can nonetheless show by circumstantial evidence evidence of disparate impact, and therefore, under the McDonnell-Douglas case, a Supreme Court case, shift the burden to the employer to explain why this is not discrimination on the basis of the protected class that's involved. And if the employer fails to meet that burden, they lose. If they can show credible evidence to explain their adverse employment decision in another way, a benign way, then of course they've met that burden. So disparate impact does come into it under that McDonnell-Douglas case.
Go ahead.
Which raises, there's a related question here is whether affirmative action will be required for gender identity and sexual orientation by OFCCP, and that's yet to be determined. Just a few months ago, OFCCP issued final regulations requiring affirmative action as to sex discrimination and veteran status, and so it's an open question whether OFCCP exercises its regulatory discretion and does that as to sexual orientation and gender identity.
It seems to me it gets pretty complicated at those points when an employer is then left to provide evidence of the makeup of their workforce. I guess we're all pretty comfortable now answering questions and filling out forms about our race and our sex, but I don't think there are people are being asked on employment forms, for example, to disclose their sexual orientation and matters like that. How would that work? Or are people working through this process now, where if somebody's trying to defend an employment practice, how do they characterize their workforce? How do they know what their workforce is or isn't? And how do they know what the pool of applicants have been and have not been in terms of gender identity and sexual orientation?
So this is Stanley. This is getting way beyond my level of specific competence, but I think a question like that, in fact, is one reason why there has been a lot of concern in Congress and more broadly, certainly in the religious community, about sexual orientation, non-discrimination, possibly also gender identity discrimination. Because it's just a different, as I indicated, an area here where there's not the same clear-cutness that has been true in many other categories, and including asking employers to probe into questions that neither they nor the employee particularly wants to know about or reveal or make that part of the conversation. So I think there's some real concern about how to end unjustified, wrongful discrimination without opening up questions and concerns and people's, private lives and so on in a way that may be quite harmful.
This is Carl Esbeck.
Professor Esbeck, before you answer, let me just mention the phone lines are lighting up now. We've got three questions pending. So if you want to go forward, go ahead. But otherwise, we'll go back.
Well, just real quickly, I think it is a new frontier, and we don't know if you work for a state employer like I do, you are asked your sexual orientation, but it's optional. In other words, you don't have to respond, which I think is accommodating your desire for privacy. But you're encouraged to respond if you self-identify as gay, lesbian, or bisexual, and so on. But of course, you also fill out other categories, race and age and gender and so on.
All right, three questions pending. Let's go to our next caller.
Yes, Stephen Casey here from Austin, Texas. And I'm curious as to, whenever one of y'all mentioned the executive order, the old one from the 60s, it seemed that that was a springboard from the prior Congressional Act of the Civil Rights Act. So it was basically recognizing what the nation, and I would parse this that we're a republic that acts with democratic means. What the nation in its republic form of government had chosen, how does it reflect upon the legitimacy of this executive order, which has not cleared Congress, is not springboarding from some across the nation republic type piece of legislation, and is instead coming from a top-down rather than a bottom-up based on congressional action?
This is a family. Excellent question. I think although this particular executive order is amending one that goes back to 1965, I think the actual set of executive orders having to do with employment discrimination and federal contracts goes back into World War II with FDR and defense industry and asking African American soldiers to fight, but not being able to be hired in defense industry by certain companies. So there was a kind of lead there that came in those executive orders. We're now getting into another set of topics in which, as you indicate, there hasn't been certainly a congressional decision about adding these to the federal set of non-discrimination requirements. So it could be said that this is the executive branch leading in a different way than it did before. And is that problematic? What does that have to do with the democratic decision-making of the whole public?
This is Robin Wilson. I wanted to say, Mr. Casey, that's an excellent question. I love Austin, by the way. I practiced in Houston and went to Austin every time I could. I think it's really interesting, and a bellwether I didn't mention, that after Hobby Lobby, what we saw was five prominent gay rights groups, including the ACLU and Lambda Legal, publicly withdraw their support for the proposed federal ENDA, basically because they said that the religious liberty exemption would be too big. That's a tragedy because I think the fact that ENDA had passed the Senate in November was a historical milestone in its own way, since it had languished in every Congress since 1994, and that religious liberty exemption had helped pull it across the finish line in the Senate. I think earlier before the call, someone was giving an update about ENDA, and perhaps they can do that after I conclude. But in many ways, what would be really good here is if we could find those protections in a piece of legislation at the federal level that has that wide democratic appeal and stamp of approval that you seem to value, Mr. Casey, at the same time that we protect religious objectors or religious dissenters and give them a way to step off and be able to continue to operate their organizations in ways that are important. And there's some very, really, really good writing by people like Rick Garnett and Rob Bisher talking about how we want to have mediating institutions in society like religious groups be able to live out their, you know, particular religious identities. And we are at risk of losing that if we can't find compromises that allow both sides to live together, as Professor Aspect said.
We've got two questions pending. I'm going to take the unusual step here of trying to get each question on the board, and then we'll let the speakers respond to each as they may.
Yes, this is Matthew Kesmerick, and I work for the Liberty Institute in Texas. I was wondering if any of the professors have identified a central collection point for the various memoranda on LGBT physician papers, as Professor Espec and Stanley know. I spent the last 6 years working in the Department of Justice, and there are various memos on everything from Batson versus Kentucky to state of celebration rules, things like that. Are you aware of an aggregator that keeps tabs on all that? Because they are, the administration is pushing these different redefinitions of sex discrimination and things like that at various levels, but I don't know if there's anybody that has their thumb on the pulse of the entire Leviathan.
Anybody have an answer to that?
This is Robin Wilson. I do not, but one thing I would mention is at least the letters that Carl, I, and others like Doug Laycock have done arguing for same-sex marriage exemptions are collected at Mirror of Justice. That's only one small piece of what you were talking about.
Let's take our final question here.
This is David Applegate in Chicago. I just wanted to note that one major private employer here in Chicago has recently surveyed its employees as to their sexual preference or sexual orientation, as well as to their comfort level in dealing with people's sexual orientation. That was J.P. Morgan Chase, and it received a great deal of negative publicity in the business press. So if that's something that our speakers are not familiar with, I think the results of that and the reports on that would be very easy to find.
Is that fairly recent, Mr. Applegate? Oh, we might have lost him. Okay. Let me say on behalf of the Federalist Society, this has been very interesting and informative. I want to thank Professor Carl Espec, Professor Stanley Carlson Tease, Dr. Stanley Carlson Tease, and Professor Robin Wilson for joining us here today. I want to thank the audience for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. And a reminder about our next Teleforum conference call scheduled for tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be getting a litigation update on the Fisher affirmative action case. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.